Good afternoon. So today we're going to do exam review, which is going to be I'll cover topics you ask me to cover. If you don't ask me to cover it, I won't cover it. If you don't have anything, suggestions, it will be very short. So I'll just write down topics and then we'll sort them and I'll go through them after I collect a whole bunch of them. So who has something they'd like answered? Yes. You can ask me to go over specific questions from exams. If you do so, I do not have the questions memorized, especially not by number. So please tell me generally what's it about so I can mix it in with other discussions of that topic. So, yes?
Can you go over write misses, specifically write allocates and no write allocates?
Write misses and write allocates, write no allocate, okay? Yes? Kind types of misses, okay? Yes.
Can you go over how write back works and like how you use a 30 bit?
Write back 30 bits, okay? Yes.
Can you go over forwarding?
Forwarding, okay. Anything more specific?
Nope.
Really. Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over how aliasing relates to loop unrolling and cache
blocking? And loop unrolling and cache blocking. Okay? Yeah.
Talk about some like dependencies and passwords, like what implies what.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over question 5 on the fall 2017 exam, which is like talking about caches and different kinds of caches?
Okay. Yes.
A more general question. I know you mentioned before in some of the previous lectures that you were like super emphasizing the most recent stuff, but what did you like know stuff
okay.
about the
most recent Okay. Other things that can answer? Yes. Okay. Exceptions. Okay.
I have like a logistical question. Before the last exam, you talked about like how to make clarifications on the questions.
Okay. Okay. Other. Yes.
More specifically, how to go over how bubbles and stuff are used.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over how to calculate the number of cache misses for like, a given size of array, including the
cache? Counting cache misses, okay. Okay, so let's order these. So we have a bunch of write policy questions. We have some types of misses questions, which probably go with counting cache misses. That goes together. We have optimization question. We have some logistical. Okay. So let's start with some logistical things. So coverage versus the lecture. So this is approximately proportional to how much time spent in lecture since last exam may incidentally cover stuff beforehand. Like for example, if you can't trace what YID6 COS does, you might be in trouble. Like probably, like that's the biggest things are things that we've covered beforehand, like how YID6 sets condition codes, you need to know, even though, you know, that might not be the primary point of the question, it might come up. And we reserve the right to ask a handful of questions on older stuff that we think needs to be asked about, but it will not be the focus of the exam. So unprecise exceptions, not covered, wait for exam 3. So that's a topic that will be covered later in the course. On clarifications on the question, put an asterisk in the box. Whatever the box is, put an asterisk. If we don't see an asterisk, we will assume you just wrote stuff some, you know, most of the time. Generally, good clarification are you think, you know, assumption you think you needed to make. So usually the form of a clarification will be like, you didn't specify the block size, and I think I need that to answer this question. So you can write a clarification which says, I'm assuming the block size is like equal to one array element or something like that. Like that, the most common clarification could be like, you think that we asked a question which is not complete in some way. Just tell us, like make a reasonable assumption about what you need to complete it and tell us what that is and that you need to make it. You can guess that we probably don't think there's that sort of error, but you know, when it is, like it's usually that we assume something was obvious and you would assume it. That's, and often you'll think probably they meant that, like you can just write that. And that should be the usual form of a clarification. In other cases, like if you think like the statement has multiple interpretations, like say assuming like this means that sort of thing. Okay. So let's start with types of cache misses. So we had this compulsory, capacity, and conflict. So compulsory. So one way I like thinking about this is we would have this miss, you know, in even if something happened. So miss even if we change the cache size to infinity. See if the cache infinitely large, if it's still a miss, if we do that, it's a compulsory miss. So so these are generally first time we access a block ever. Like no matter how big our cache is, still we can't do anything about it. So capacity miss is miss even if fully associative. So if we make the cache fully associative, so we never have to worry about is something else in the same set, is that what the problem is? Do we still have a miss? Then it's a capacity miss. So just not enough room, you know, no extra space even in other sets. So even if we look at the other sets, there wasn't room for all the values we wanted to store, we still have those misses. Yes?
Now that you mentioned fully associative, how do you calculate the number of ways? What part of the decision?
Fully associative, which means number of ways equals total number of blocks. Yes?
So would a capacity miss happen in those situations where we're talking about loading a 4 megabyte array into like a 2 megabyte cache?
So the question is, would a capacity miss happen where we have a 4 megabyte array and 2 megabyte cache? Yes. And that would those would be capacity misses, especially since the array is contiguous, so we know that like it's going to use all the sets. Yes?
Can you repeat that? Sorry.
So if we have a 4 megabyte array into a 2 megabyte cache, we know that's going to be a capacity miss.
Like 4 megabyte array and what?
And we have a 2 megabyte cache, we're using all the 4 megabyte array, we're going to have capacity misses, just not enough room. And we know there's no conflict misses, especially because the array is contiguous, so we're going to use all of the sets. So conflict miss is anything else. Since we, in this class, will not talk about any other kinds of misses. There are some, but we don't talk about them. Anything else, or alternately, miss, but there was a room elsewhere. There was some good place to put it elsewhere in the cache, elsewhere other sets, in other sets. That there was some other set we could have placed the value and avoided the miss. Okay, so those are types of misses. Yes?
Before we go to counting cache misses, can you explain the advantages and disadvantages of fully associative versus direct math?
We'll add that to the list of topics for our second round. So counting cash misses. So the steps I like using. So first, figure out what thing, you know, how to find the set indexes. So there's two options here. So either A, figure out the index bits and write down the indexes. Or B, figure out the distance between things that map to the same set, which is equal to the number of bytes per way. Because remember, if each way is 1 megabyte, when we go ahead 1 megabyte, that maps to the same set because bytes per way, which equals to 2 to the number of index plus offset bits. And so when we go ahead by 2 to the index plus offset bits, we're not changing any of the index bits. So things which are exactly that far apart map to the same way. So e.g., in a 1 megabyte direct map cache, address 0 and 0 plus 1 megabyte are in the same set. In a two-way, 2 megabyte set associative cache, address 0 and 0 plus 1 megabyte are in the same set. And you can also figure this out by just looking at what the set index bits are, and you'll realize if you add 1 megabyte, none of the set index bits change. Because they're all lower than 1 megabyte is 1000 in binary. All the zeros are where the set index bits are. So either you figure this out, and this will tell you, find the sets used. And this, you know, either way, identify accesses to the same set. And the idea is then you can consider each set separately, because only things from the same set can possibly interfere as far as counting misses. You don't need to worry about any of the other sets because they're independent. So then go through the accesses and see accesses. So if something was never accessed before, then it's a miss. If something was accessed before, check what else from the set was accessed, and depending on the replacement policy, you'll do different things. So if LRU too many things more recently, it's a miss. More recent implies miss. If FIFO too many things brought in more recently, used more recently, it's a miss. Brought in equals missed. And remember, when something's brought into the cache, it was a miss. So you just look at, for FIFO, you just look at, when did we last miss in this? Did we bring in other things from misses? You know, is it the first thing that got out at some point? Yes. Least recently used. So LRU equal, and consider the replacement policy. So LRU is least recently used. FIFO is least first in, first out. So you can just look at the previous accesses and figure it out. Obviously, that's not how a real cache works. A real cache needs to like keep track of which is least recently used, which is the second least recently used, or which was brought in most recently, which was brought in second most recently, and so on. But you can just look back at the accesses to do it by hand. Usually that's easier when you're doing a problem by hand, especially if you like have a loop where you like just need to say, when do we access the same set? This was I equals 8, I equals 16, and so on. Yeah.
Under one, why
So if we think of this direct map cache, then we have some B block offset bits, and so and S set index bits, and we know that 2 to the B times 2 to the S equals 1 megabyte, which means that B plus S equals 20, which means that if we take 1 mega, if we take 1 M, 2 to the 20, that, no, so that X plus 2 to the 20 doesn't change the bottom 20 bits. So we know that adding 2 to the 20 to an address doesn't change the set index bits or the block offset bits. So that means if we take any address, add 2 to the 20 to it, or any multiple of 2 to the 20, we end up with something that goes to the same set. Yes?
So when you say it's a two-way, 2 megabyte set associative, each way is 1 megabyte, right?
Yes. So for the second example, it's 2-way, 2 megabyte, each way is 1 megabyte, and that's what determines the set index bits and block offset bits, the sum of the two. Yes? Yeah, so too many equals more than blocks per set. And it's the same here. So you just count, like, if it's, because basically the most recently used thing, the second most recently used thing, up to the number of blocks you have per set, those are the things that were in the cache when we tried to access this. So if you have two ways for the set, the two most recently used things are in it, if you have an LRU policy. If you have a FIFO policy, the two things that missed most recently in that set are in the cache. And everything before that that was accessed is not, just because there's only that many blocks in a set. Yes?
For like next round of questions, can we go over like the metadata caches?
So that's, okay, so this is the whole, like, go through, yes, and I guess otherwise, a hint. Yeah, and I guess miss, otherwise, if these don't match, miss, otherwise, hit. And similarly, otherwise, hit, otherwise, hit, you know, and if we have, we have some other policies, like if random, I don't know how you'd figure that out reliably. Like you'd have to do some probability, and you could figure it out, a rule for other policies. Okay, and then we have a question about fall 2017 Q5. Oh, right. We need to go to the directory where the old exams are. To see. Here. Okay. So this question. So this question says that we access a 2 megabyte array in order, and we repeat this 1,000 times, and which of these designs has the fewest cache misses? So one observation is that the array is bigger than all these caches. And we're accessing it all at once, all together, so we're gonna have lots of capacity misses. Also, because we're accessing it in order, whenever we access the first byte of a block, we're gonna access the remainder of a block. So the upper bound on the number of misses we can have is based on the number of blocks, because number of blocks times the number of iterations. And that means that smaller blocks, because we're asking for fewest misses, not fewest bytes of misses, is worse. All other things being equal. So let's work out, we have these various policies, let's work out what happens with each of them. So I'm gonna draw a thing. So we have a 2 megabyte array. So here, this is 2 megabytes. And let's consider first our our option B, which is a 1.75 megabyte fully associative cache. So with the 1.75 megabyte cache, we're going to first read the first 1.75 meg of the array. We're going to put that in our cache the first time we go through it. So these are all misses. Let's see if we can, when we access this again, whether there'll be hits. So let's consider, now we're going to read the last 0.25 megabytes of the array. So I want to read this. And I have a fully associative cache with a FIFO policy. So it's fully associative, so everything's a candidate to be removed from the cache to put that in. And I'm going to take the thing I put in first. And remember, I read the array in order. So the thing I put in first is exactly here. So when we read that, we end up with, so we have our 2 megabytes here again. We end up that we have added this to our cache, and we have this whole thing here is what's in our cache. We're missing the first piece, and we're gonna, in fact, keep going. And we're going to end up, when we get to the end of the array, we're going to have when we read this part here, we're going to end up evicting the remainder here. And we're going to have exactly the beginning out of the cache. And the next thing we're going to do is we're going to go through the array again. So we're going to read from here and evict from here, and so on. So we have this sort of chasing our tail phenomenon here, where we're always evicting something that pretty soon we're going to read again. And we never have a case where, with this FIFO replacement policy, even with this fully associative cache, we ever have a hit. The first time it's a miss because we never accessed it before. And the second time, well, we've accessed everything else, everything's in the same set. We apply our counting policy, everything's in the same set. But we looked, we've accessed enough stuff beforehand that we put in missed that the stuff that when we access it the second time, it's not a hit. So looking at that policy before, when we access this the second time, it's not the first access. We look at the stuff we accessed before, we accessed 2 megabytes of stuff that missed in the cache before we accessed it, and that's enough to run out of space in the set, even though the set holds 1.75 megs. And that's going to be true for every point in this array. So every single access is a miss. So with the FIFO 1.75 meg fully associative, we have 2 megabytes times 1,000 iterations divided by 64 bytes. No misses. 64 bytes because this is the cache block size. Because we have to, each iteration we have to load into the cache every single cache block. Even though all but the first iteration we've accessed that cache block before. Yes?
But what doesn't make sense to me is why do you stop at 1.75?
Yeah,
I'm just a little confused because the first one is manually replaced.
This is B. I'm skipping A for now. So this is the 1.75 fully associative cache. I will get back to A in a second. Okay. So then we had another cache, which was our next one, I believe, is the 0.5 megabytes direct mapped. So we have 0.5 meg direct map cache. So again, we have our 2 meg array. And we're going to first read the first 0.5 megabytes in. And here we have a direct map cache. So we have the values here mapped to the same sets as the values here, mapped to the same sets as the values here, because this is 0.5 megaparts. Because that's the size of each way in this cache. So when we read the values here, we're going to evict the values over here. So after we access that, we're going to end up with a scenario where we have, or where our cache contains this, you know, this little chunk moving forwards, and we're going to keep doing that. So eventually we're going to have our cache containing this next 0.5 megabyte chunk, and we're going to keep going forwards, and we're going to, again, never, it's never going to be the case that we look at any particular part when we access this the second next time. Well, we've accessed plenty of stuff, other stuff more recently that maps to the same set, and there's only one thing you can put in there, so anything more recently, and we're in trouble. So again, everything is misses, so we have 2 megabytes times 1,000 iterations divided by the block size, which happened to be 32 byte block size misses. So in fact, more misses than the fully associated because of the smaller block size. So the other cache we had was an 8-way 1 megabyte cache. So here, we're going to, without any problems, read in the first megabyte. And then we need to consider, well, what's going to happen when I read in this next little chunk? And our ways are an eighth of a megabyte. So this little chunk here maps to the same way as this little chunk, as this little chunk, as this little chunk, and this little chunk, and this little chunk, and this little chunk, and here. So this all are part of, mapped to the same sets. And remember, we look at the sets. Sorry, I have the wrong number of chunks. We have 8 chunks here. Because they're, so we have 8 of these. It gets very busy. So these are 1/8 of a megabyte apart. So if we look at these chunks, we're going to evict the most least recently used, which is back here. And so in fact, when we access the next chunk piece there, we evict that. So we end up advancing to something where we have our cache instead contains this, and then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to try to add this, and then we're going to end up evicting this. By similar reasoning, we look at the things which map to the same set. We have a candidate here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, but the least recently used is the one we evict. And we again have this chasing our tail phenomenon that we always end up evicting it. And we can do this argument where if we look at this set here, we find out other things that map to the same set, that there's, that between iterations we have 15 of them that we access, 15 other things map to the same set, and more recently than the last time we accessed that thing at the beginning, so they're all going to be misses again. So again, everything's misses. We have this sort of phenomenon where we're again chasing our tail. And this makes sense with the LRU policy because the thing we're accessing is the least recently used part of the array. Every time. We're always accessing the least recently used thing in the array. So we end up with 2 megabytes times 1,000 over the block size again. Misses. Which is the same as our fully associative. So questions about what's on here? Yes?
You said something about more recently than the thing we accessed.
So when we're accessing this the second time, we accessed, the accesses was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, 14, 15, 16. And then the second time is 17 for here. So if we look at the things we accessed from the same set, well, we accessed 1, 2, 3, 2 through 16 more recently than we accessed this when we're accessing it on it times 17. And so we say, well, that's too much stuff. With our policy, those 2 to 16 are the only things that could possibly be in the cache. In fact, it has to be 8 through 16 is what's in the cache. Like everything else, we evicted because of the LRU least recently used policy.
So how does that relate to the number of misses?
So that means it's a miss the second time we access this, and by a similar argument, the third time we access it, and the fourth time, and the fifth time. And that argument applies to every single part of this array. When we do that analysis, we find, oh, there are 16 other places in the array which map to the same set, and 8 of them, at least, have been accessed since the last time we accessed the same block.
And how does that help you compute how many misses?
So the question is, how does that help us compute how many misses? By knowing that every access to a block is a miss, we just need to know that we just need to count the number of times we access each block, basically. Which is what I'm doing here. I'm saying we have 2 megabytes, which we access 1,000 times. And the first time in each iteration we access each block, it has to be a miss because we haven't accessed that block recently enough since the last time. So we have, I guess one thing I'm omitting is the first time we access it, it's a miss because, well, we couldn't have brought it into the cache at all. The second time, we're saying, hopefully it's still in the cache from the last time I accessed it, but we look at other accesses to the same set and we find out, no, that can't be the case. Because we accessed enough other stuff that goes to the same set, and with our replacement policy, that stuff replaced the thing, the last access. At some point, we had to get rid of it. The question is, why do I need to think about it picture-wise? I needed to show that they're all misses. So, for example, a much harder version of this question. So, the question is, why did I need to do that reasoning? Did I really need to do that? And the answer is probably not. But it gets more tricky if we have something like, I have a 1.1 megabyte, or I guess we should do power of two sizes. So if I have a 1.125 megabyte and lots of ways, then this is what fits in our cache. But if our cache is say 4-way, then this last part here would map to the same set as we have this beginning here, here, and this here. But the stuff immediately after that would only have 4 things that map to the same set in the cache. Because here we have, this is 0.125, this is 0.125 plus 1/4 plus 1/2 plus 3/4. So there's only 3 places for those red blocks to map to our 4-way cache, so we'd actually have some hits. Like, so it's not enough to just know, oh, the cache is bigger than the array, they must all be misses. Because with a something like the case like this, like that might not happen. just because like it's not bigger enough that like most of the stuff gets evicted, but some of the stuff, there's four things in the set and four places for it to go, we're gonna have some hits. But there's stuff in purple, there's five places for it to go, we're gonna have all misses. But we actually needed to do that analysis to see how many places were there for it to know that. Because we have to know, we ran out of space, we actually ran out of space for that set. Okay. So then we get to our random replacement policy. So with the random replacement policy, we have the same sort of phenomena as here, but well, we look at things going to the same set and we realize, wait a moment, just because I accessed a whole bunch of other things before I accessed this block a second time with a random replacement policy, probably I got rid of it, but maybe not. So because the random replacement policy allows us to have some hits, if we just get lucky enough that we didn't choose that thing we accessed again, because we always had a choice, because we had four ways, so we could have always not chosen it, so we have some hits. And because we have some hits, we end up that means that the random replacement policy, you know, is going to have some hits beside the, on the other iterations. And you note that the maximum number of misses it can have is the same as any of the other cases with 64-byte blocks. Because we know we always, when we access the first part of a block, we access the rest of it. And so the random is the correct answer here. So questions about that before I move on a bit? Okay, so write misses. So a write miss means try to write means value was not, you know, the address we wrote to was not in the cache. It does not depend on the write allocate or write no allocate policy. It matters more depending on which of those policies you've chosen, but it doesn't depend on it. So when we write to a cache, we need to A, decide. So I guess we'll just do write policies. So we have our first decision, which is write allocate. If, yeah, writing not in the cache, should I bring it in? That decision is write allocate. If we choose write allocate, we're answering yes. Then we have write back through. If it's in my cache now, after I make the write allocate decision, if it's in my cache, either because it was already or because I put it there, should I all update? Should I just update my cache, or should I also update memory? So write back is I just update my cache, and I'll update memory later. Write through is I always update memory. So note that you can choose any combination of these decisions and you still know what you're doing. So if you choose write no allocate write back, if it's not in the cache, you don't put it in, and well, it's not in the cache to update, so you have to update memory. If you choose write allocate write through, if it's not in the cache, you bring it in, but you still always update memory and you and the cache. So write back in dirty bits. So dirty bit means that cache doesn't value in cache doesn't equal value in memory. Memory needs to be updated. The dirty bit is how we keep track of that, because if we do a write back policy, so write back policy, they might get out of sync. If we do a write through policy, we just never let them get out of sync. If they get out of sync, use to send updates to memory when evicted. If we didn't track this, well, we replaced something in our cache, and suddenly that value we wrote, when you read it back, it's not the same. Very confusing. You wouldn't want that to happen, so we have to keep track of it somewhere. We're going to update memory. And we don't want to pay the cost of updating memory every time we evict something, because usually we aren't updating the values. Usually we're just reading. Or at least often enough that it's a big cost. Okay, so dependencies versus hazards. So dependency means, you know, does not depend on the CPU. That's the key thing. Dependency is a property of code, it's not a property of our CPU. So means we need, you know, X depends on Y, or has a dependency on Y means we need X to X's result to compute Y. So we have like data dependencies where you need X's result meaning the data. We have control dependencies where you need X's result meaning information about how we're to set the PC. So hazard for a particular CPU design. So hazard, we have to choose a CPU design to know if there's hazards. That is, so natural implementation, i.e. so no forwarding, stalling, branch prediction, etc., would do the wrong thing. That's what a hazard means. So for a control hazard, the natural implementation, like for a conditional jump, we have no idea what to do. Like without any of these techniques, we have to wait. We have to stall, we have to do something. Natural implementation for data hazards. If we don't do anything, we don't implement forwarding, well, we're gonna read the wrong values. So wrong result, do the wrong thing, or you know, just not know what to do. So forwarding. So forwarding means that, you know, instead of writing a value to a register file, to the register file, and reading it back, which takes time, you know, which requires waiting for a write back / decode. You know, write back stage is the biggest issue. Send the value directly. And the general pattern is we want to look at, you know, where is the value computed. And generally, you know, For looking at forwarding. So when, I guess just say, when is the value computed? So I'll give an example where we do a combination of forwarding and stalling. So we have like MR move Q, RAX, RAX, add Q, RAX, RAX. So when is the value computed? At near the end of MR move Q's memory stage. When is the value used? Near the beginning of add queue's execute stage. So to determine where we're forwarding, we need to line, first of all, we need to line up the instructions so this time dependency works out. If it doesn't, we're going to need to stall. And in this case, we're going to find out that we have our code and we need the add queue to be lined up so that the execute is after the memory stage. Because here we have 1, and here we have 2. And they need to not be misordered. If we have this, we're saying we're going back in time. Can't do that. So we have to have them line up like this. Back. So that's the questions we need to answer. And once we, so then we get them, arrange, make sure we stall to get them, get one after the other. Then we need to steal the value. So in addQueue, instead of taking RAX from the register file, take it from MRMoveQueue's pipeline input, pipeline register input. That's the general pattern. So in HCLRS, we're going to do something where we have something like dvala, and we're going to have some case, some condition where we choose to take mvalm, which was mem output. If, for example, we are forwarding, that's their typical forwarding code in the same. For dvalb. Yes.
So you'll be stalling all the stages previous to
So in this case, we need to do stalling and forwarding.
What about both?
So we'll get to that in a second. So combining the two examples because talk about partly because I want to emphasize that we can do both. So in this case, we're doing forwarding. We're forward taking the value we get from memory and using it to replace, the value we get from the register file. Yes? Question is, are you going to need to write HCL code on the exam? No writing. We might describe a circuit with HCL code, etc. Do that. So to figure out where you do forwarding, you should answer these questions and figure out, question 3, make sure we stall, and question 3, do we have, after we stall enough, do we have to do something besides read the register file? Because if we just read the register file, without forwarding, at the end of MRMoveQueue's write back. And without forwarding, this would be at the near the beginning of addQueue's decode. So that would require a lot more stalling if we didn't have forwarding. And that's what we're avoiding, is that. So this is with forwarding. So we're doing 1 cycle of stalling. And without forwarding, we'd have to here's our 1. And our addQueue is going to be, here's our 2. That's what we're going to have to do. And that's what we're avoiding by not using the register file to send a value. Forwarding. So bubbles, bubbles install. So So I think the biggest source of confusion is that there's two things we call stalling. So we have stalling and instruction. It means stopping the instruction from advancing to another pipeline stage. Versus stalling a register means keeping the register from being updated. These are different things. We use one to implement the other, but they are different. So in particular, when we stall an instruction, like the example above, we want to have, so we have some instructions. Let's say we have our stages, and at some point we have A, B, I'll write these in order. We have instructions E, D, C, B, A in those stages. And normally, if we don't do anything, we're going to end up with F, D, C, B. And stall D, let's say we're stalling D, keeping D from advancing, we're going to end up with D in the decode stage, and E behind it is not going to be able to go forwards, and I didn't give any instructions that I want to get rid of E. So that means that I'm going to want to also keep E in fetch. And other things we're going to have advance as usual. So C is going to advance as usual, and B is going to advance as usual. And we have this hole here, which we need to fill with something. And we don't want to have that filling do anything, so we're going to fill that with an. So to implement the stall, this stall of instruction D, we're going to stall the register feeding the PC. Stall the PC that register, keep E, fetch E again. We're going to, with some caveats about mispredictions, and we're going to stall the fetch to decode registers, use D's values again. Because D has like values we fetch from the memory, we want to use those again the next cycle. So we're going to stall those registers. So D continues getting from those registers, you know, the same register numbers and so on. And we're going to bubble the decode to execute registers. And bubble, remember, means the register output values for NOP. Okay, so questions about stalls and bubbles, something I missed here? Yes.
Can you walk through the first question on the Spring 2017
exam? So that would be here. So we have a 5-stage spectral processor. And it's asking what should happen during, okay, we'll get to this later. So this is branch prediction is the real problem here. So do that in the second round. Okay. Or S2017 exam 2Q1. So let's go on to the last topic, aliasing and cache blocking away from rolling. So first, aliasing, what is it? Means two names for the same value. So one example is if we have some int A and we have int star x equals A10 and int star y equals a 20, then x tend and y 0 are the same value. That's an example of aliasing. So aliasing and loop unrolling. So these are not very related. So for loop unrolling, compiler needs to know the loop index, e.g. I and the loop bound n. So in, for example, I in this. Needs to know what those are, needs to know how those change. So maybe aliasing could make it hard to tell how I is changed. You know, e.g. does the loop body change I? Right. But then I would need to be something which has a pointer to it. And in this case, that's not possible. Because this is not possible unless the code somewhere takes a pointer to I. And we know that because it's a local variable. So the only way we could get a pointer to it is by taking one. And because a vast majority of loops use local variables like this, it's rarely a problem for compilers to do loop unrolling because of aliasing. Like, yes, we're using array elements in the loop, but we don't care about the loop body, we just make copies of it. So if we have some body here, you know, the compiler is just going to be generating code like that. It doesn't need to know what's happening in the body, just that it doesn't interfere with I and N. As long as it can show it doesn't interfere with I and N, it doesn't need to worry. And usually I and N are local variables or something computed from local variables, so it's pretty obvious that duplicating it like that doesn't change how I and N are set. Yeah? I guess we should do the pros and cons of loop unrolling. I'll add that to the list here. So I think we're gonna run out of time. Okay. So aliasing, it's usually not a problem for it. Technically, it could make it harder for it to figure out how to do the unrolling, in particular how to like check that I is less than N doesn't change because of one of the bodies and actually eliminate comparisons. But usually that's not a problem. So, but cache blocking, it's a bigger problem, because if we think of our typical cache blocking scenario, we have something like where we access some A, and, we usually access multiple arrays in the loop, and there's something we're going to do cache blocking over. So, even if we think of here, if we're doing something like that, well, the compiler has two things which are probably accessed with pointers. Probably pointers. Compiler can't, do cache blocking without worrying they point to the same array. So if they point to the same array, then that doesn't make sense in a human perspective, but there's a correct answer for the code if they point to the same array. Where we change the thing we're reading later or don't, and the compiler needs to faithfully reproduce that. And that would prevent a cache blocking transformation on this loop where we would want to, cache blocking change the order of I and J. We want to change the order we access A and B. And it's hard for the compiler to know that that's not going to change the answer because if it worries that A and B are parts of the same array, like this scenario I set up here. we as a human know that like probably the person writing that code doesn't mean that to happen, but like if you would expect that if you did call it that way that it would do exactly, you know, the same as if the same order, including reading things you changed in the middle of the loop correctly. Okay, so let's go to our bonus questions here. So fully associative versus direct map. So fully associative is the most flexible. Fully associative, as I said, is associativity equals the number of blocks. It's the most flexible possible and also really expensive to implement because you have lots of comparisons for every lookup. You have lots of tag comparisons. Direct map is associativity equals 1, least flexible possible, really fast, really easy slash fast to implement. Like, if you want the fastest possible cache as far as like hit time, like direct map caches will do that. Also has the advantage that like you can figure out what value you would have, if it's a hit, you can figure out the value that you're hitting before you actually compare the tag. Like, you know what the value is if it's a hit immediately, which with a set associative cache, while you have several candidates, you don't know which one until you actually compare the tags. So generally, we will pretty much never see, you know, so almost never used for data or instruction caches. There are other types of caches we will talk about after this exam, which sometimes are fully associative. But for data instruction caches, because it's so expensive, it's almost never used in practice. It just costs way too much for what we want to use a data cache for. And our instruction cache for, so you'll pretty much never see them. But we do talk about them because they, you know, are good for reasoning about conflict messes. You know, they tell us like if something's a conflict miss, which is good for also knowing like, do I want to change the associativity? Looking at the most extreme example tells you like, is it worth changing the associativity? Well, the fully associative cache wouldn't help, it's not. Okay, so metadata and caches. So we have a valid bit for every block. Otherwise, how do we need a way to represent an empty cache? We can't just choose we have to have some bits for the tag. Like there's no value, which doesn't mean anything. So we need to put a valid bit to know that. You know, if write back, tag bits are probably the next most important. We need to, you know, regardless of the associativity, we need the tag bits to know, well, there's multiple things which map to the set, is this the right one? And then if write back, we have a dirty bit, do I need to update memory eventually? Or is my value different than the one in memory? And we have bits to implement replacement policies, e.g. for LRU, ordered a list of blocks, most to least recently accessed. Would be one possible representation. I'm not saying it's the only way to represent it, but we need to somehow represent the information we need for the replacement policy. Yes?
So you're saying that we have a list of bits that have most recently used, second most recently used?
We have to represent the information about the order of the blocks. We might have a more clever way of doing that than the most straightforward way of writing a list down.
Okay.
but it's going to represent that information somehow because you can, you know, you can tell the difference between all the orders by accessing the right things. So it has to be written down there somewhere. Yes.
Are the tag bits separate from just like the tag bits that you would get from like the address
of the database? So the question is, are the tag bits different than the tag bits of the address? They have the same value, but we need to store a copy of them in the cache to compare with the address the cache gets. Because they could be different. Yes.
What is the valid bit again?
The valid bit is, you know, valid equals one, one block is used, valid equals zero, block is unused, ignore everything else. And this is, you think of our cache starts off with all the valid bits as zero. This is how we know that there's nothing there, not that everything that's there has tag zero, right? Because there is actually a value with tag zero for every set, which we could store in the cache, and we need to distinguish that from there's nothing there. Okay. So then we have the exam question on branch prediction. So let me move this. Really, is that that over to there? So there. And that. Okay, so the question asks, we have, relevantly, we have NQ RAX RAX JLE later not taken, IR move Q, sub Q later, we have add Q, Q and halt. So this is a snippet of assembly code that we have, and we're asking what's happening during, and the question is Q, what bubble register bubble stall signals during JLE's execute? And with the strategy discussed in class. So we have fetch, decode, execute, and write back here. Let's write these in the order that they actually happen. So we have NQ, which gets fetch, decoded, execute, memory write back. And this sets the condition codes, which are used by JLE. So JLE gets fetched, decoded, and in its execute, it reads the condition codes. JLE's execute, and the question also mentions that Q cause add Q slash halt to be squashed. Read right back. And remember, we do branch prediction. So we first predict later here, zero. So we fetch that instruction, that add Q. And then we do later plus one, which is halt. And then we fetch that instruction. But we don't allow them to proceed past the jumps execute. So we cut this off, and they get squashed. And the reason they get squashed is because we find out at this point, we made a misprediction, later plus zero, add Q, and later plus one halt are squashed. And the reason we squash at this point is that this keeps the squashing now. Now keeps later plus zero add Q from changing the condition codes. So if we squashed later, we'd have to somehow prevent the condition codes from changing. So this is the most straightforward way of doing that, and the way we recommended doing it in class, even though I know some of you didn't do that on Pipe Homework 2, which is what the JXX OpQ squash test was testing for. And if you failed that test and not many others related to JXX, this is probably what you did. You probably squashed a little later. So, and at this point, we're going to fetch the actual iremove queue that's afterwards. So we have fetch decode execute memory write back. And that's fetched during JLE's execute memory stage. So we figure out the condition codes and execute, and the next stage we can fetch the write instruction. And then in the following stage we have subqueue, which goes on as so usual. So the question is, during the execute stage, how do we set up the registers? And remember that when we tell a register to bubble or stall, we're telling it what to do in the next cycle. Stall signals. So bubble stall signals are for what happens in the next cycle during JLE's memory. And during JLE's memory, well, so let's say JLE's executes. We have in fetch, we look up here, we have later plus one. In decode, we have, later plus zero. In execute, we have JLE. In memory, we have NQ. And in write back, not visible, we have some IRMQ. And during JLE's memory, we want there to be, if we look at this chart, we want there to be, so well, I guess we have old iremove queue. We want there to be in fetch, iremove queue, new. In decode, we want there to be nothing, because the thing in fetch, we don't want to go on to decode. That would be usually what happens. Execute, we want there to be nothing. In memory, we want there to be JLE, because it's going to go on as usual. And in write back, we want there to be NQ. And so to do that, we consider fetch to fetch. Well, is the register file feeding fetch doing the normal thing? Yes, it is. This is actually marked on the question. So that's normal. Fetch to decode. What is the fetch to decode register doing? So we have two options. Three options. If we're doing the normal thing, then later plus one would advance to decode. That's not what happens. If we stall, then later plus zero would stay in decode. That's also not what we want to happen, so we bubble. Bubble, replace, output nop. Output nop instead of normal value, which is later plus one. Decode to execute, we have the same issue. We want to bubble, output nop instead of normal value, which in this case is later plus zero. And in execute to memory, this is normal. We want to let the instruction from execute advance to memory, which is JLE, and in memory to write back, the same thing. Yes?
So for a mispredicted branch, you never have to stall.
So for a mispredicted branch, yes. The question is, do we never stall? Yes, there's no actual stalling going on. We are wasting cycles, but we are not wasting the cycles leaving an instruction in this particular stage. We are doing something else to waste the cycles, which is run mispredicted instructions. Okay, and loop unrolling trade-offs, I believe was the question. So loop unrolling, less comparison index management instructions. That's the advantage. The disadvantage, reductions for large loop number of iterations. Disadvantage is maybe more work due to for small number of iterations due to leftovers. So remember, we do in groups of if you unroll the loop four times, we do it in groups of four. you know, if we typically have like n equals 6, we do a group of 4, and then we need to check, do we have a little extra work? And that could end up being extra cost, because we do a couple extra comparisons. But with a large number of iterations, it's not a problem. Yes?
So with loop-on rule, we wouldn't have to execute jump as often.
Yes, so I guess less comparison, less conditional jumps for large number of iterations. And the disadvantage is more space in instruction cache and in binaries, right? The bigger loop, the unrolled loop, we have multiple copies of the loop body, that's going to take up more space. If we do this for every single loop, even loops that are typically executed like twice, like that's going to add up. And that's why the compiler doesn't just do it all the time, because like if you look at typical code, you have a lot of loops which are like executed like almost never. And if you compile or unroll everything, it would make your executable a lot bigger for not much benefit. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'll be here for a few minutes. There is an exam review session in lab tomorrow, which is whatever the TAs want to do, so probably something like extra office hours during the lab time. To cover that, or they could try to run something more review-like, depending on how many people they have. And also, I have office hours tomorrow evening. Yeah.
So, is there even an answer for this, or is there?